Council, the next case on our today is A22-1648. Len Brazier individually and as owner of Wagon Wheel Ridge, Inc. versus Minnesota Department of Natural Resources and Kitson Soil and Conservation District. Council can take your spots at council table and we can proceed once you're settled. I'll just give a few brief introductory procedural comments and then you can proceed. So I want to welcome you to the Court of Appeals. I'm Judge Cochran, and with me on the panel today are Judge Frisch and Judge Smith. We are recording the oral argument today. The oral argument will be available on our website in the next day or so. Counsel for appellant, you'll have 15 minutes for your oral argument, and counsel for respondents, I understand you will be splitting your 15 minutes equally, and then appellant will have an additional 5 minutes for rebuttal. For purposes of the recording, if you can please introduce yourself and the party you represent at the start of your argument, we would appreciate that. And if you have a preference for how we refer to you, please let us know that at the beginning of your argument. The podium is adjustable, and there is a clock on the podium that will show the amount of time you have remaining in your argument. Counsel for appellant, you can proceed when you're ready.
May it please the court, my name is Steve Anderson. I'm here on behalf of the appellants Glenn Brazier and Wagon Wheel Ridge. Glenn Brazier owns Wagon Wheel Ridge, so it's kind of one party. Despite all the paperwork and all the 3 years of litigation going on here, we're here today to get an answer to a very simple question, one that is at the center of the whole dispute. Does the threat of criminal charges on the DNR and Wetlands Administrative Order constitute enough criminal context to allow the parties, the appellants, to bring a 626.21 case for an illegal search?
Counsel, it strikes me that anything that would have been searched or seized potentially from the property would not be germane to the misdemeanor action for failure to comply with the restoration orders. I mean, the misdemeanor action is you either complied with the restoration order or you didn't comply with the restoration order. And whatever was discovered in a search that may or may not have been illegal is not really germane to whether you either did what they told you to do or they didn't, or you didn't do what they told you to do. So help me understand why the criminal context that you have identified, which I think is a fair criminal context, even relates to the search or the fruits of the search at all.
The appellant would argue that the whole process that allowed them to write the order began with the search. They began with the search that we claim was in violation of the rights. So it's anything forward from that. They got on the land, they did what they did, and then they issued those documents. And I understand the difference between complying with it and the actual order. Our position would be that without that search, we don't know what that order would have looked like.
But the orders are now final, and you haven't appealed those orders.
Right.
And so it seems to me that what you're talking about is a hypothetical potential misdemeanor action that could be filed in the future. We don't know if it would be. I don't know anything about whether there's been compliance or noncompliance with the restoration orders. And then in that subsequent proceeding, there would be some motion to collaterally attack the underlying orders, saying that they were invalid. Is that right? Is that how that would work?
Because
I don't know if that's allowed.
I'm not sure I quite understand your question. I'm going to give a shot at answering.
Okay. I can clarify it, too, if you'd like.
Could you clarify it a little bit?
Sure. So in a subsequent misdemeanor, hypothetical misdemeanor proceeding for failure to comply with a restoration order, the claim that I think you're saying that you would be making is that the restoration order itself is invalid. Is that right?
So the focus in this particular 626.21 action is the actual unlawful search. That's the focus.
I understand that. But you're trying to tie the criminal context of a subsequent misdemeanor, hypothetical misdemeanor proceeding to this action. And I'm wondering why the search, which is the focus of this action, is even germane to a criminal proceeding.
Yeah, what that question gets to is a fundamental problem with I'm going to call it a catch-22 that the appellants were found themselves in. If, and in the fact pattern, you're right, there was the administrative order, and after that, we were starting to appeal it, and we got a data request, and we found out that this was going on, okay? Now we were stuck with, can we file a 626.21 to get the data that we need? And that, the court has been clear on that it's there to allow you to get information before the crime is actually filed. And that's that. So we were sitting there going, well, hasn't been filed yet. In fact, you're right, it's hypothetical, but it's no more hypothetical than someone being investigated for anything else.
Well, but here in your complaint, it seemed you were concerned about the Bowser regulatory appeal and any future regulatory actions and any court actions. So it didn't seem that you were, in your complaint, it doesn't seem to be focused on a potential hypothetical criminal prosecution. It seems more focused on the regulatory proceedings.
So the argument would be that the legislators created this statute, and I agree it's inside the criminal code, all that. But it says very clearly that you can bring this action and to stop if after hearing, just decide if that was actually, there was anything going on. It by us not having access to the data that the appellate court or the administrative Bowser was looking at, and a lot of it was timing, but we just felt it was important to take every step we could to find out what was in those drillings. And so, yes, I get that I understand that it's hypothetical, but I guess I don't see how it's any more hypothetical than any other person being investigated for a crime trying to get that stopped.
Is he being investigated for a crime, though?
No, that's, I'm sorry, is facing possible criminal charges.
It, only for noncompliance with the orders.
With restoration orders.
Yes.
I want to turn to another subject, and that is there's two parts to this statute. One is suppression of the evidence, and one is the return of property.
Right.
Are you claiming that there's some property that is in the possession of the respondents that needs to be returned to you?
Depends how you define property. If it's dirt taken from a sample, yeah, then we would contend that.
Well, so on page 2 of the DNR's brief, they say that they didn't take any dirt, that any dirt that was removed from the soil borings was replaced into the property. Do you have some belief that they actually took something off of the property?
Replacing that core and then using that core to analyze what they believe happened or what the wetlands rules would have been.
But there was no soil taken off the property, was there?
Well, they say there wasn't. That's another point. I'm assuming they didn't, but we didn't get a chance to talk to the people who actually were there doing it.
You don't have any reason to believe that they're misrepresenting, that they didn't take anything from the property?
I have a reason to believe that they...
I mean, a good faith basis in law or fact.
A good faith basis, and, you know, I think they did. The problem is that they took those samples without our knowledge.
I understand. I mean, what the DNR, I mean, what the respondents say is that they drilled the bore, as I understand it. They drilled these 5 holes. They made observations. They went down, 30 inches. Yeah, they 30 inches, and they smelled some sulfur, and they saw some, you know, they pulled some cattail out, or they saw a cattail, and they saw, you know, they made other observations, and then they put everything back. And then they come back and they say, this is what we saw. We took this data. That's what they said on the attachment to the complaint. So I'm just wondering, was there something physical that they, you know, brought in and said, here's what we got. We're not giving it back to you. See you later. I mean, I don't think that that's what happened.
It didn't happen because they didn't tell us about the drilling, and they wouldn't have, that wouldn't have happened anyway, but they didn't tell us about the drilling.
Well,
but,
I thought there was there's a attachment to the complaint that describes the whole interaction about what happened during their inspection, including the drilling, right?
Yes. Yeah, so after the fact of the let me back up. So when the parties met to decide whether they'd go on that property, there was what I would call a little bit of eye hand magic going on there, okay?
But I read everything, yeah. So I know what happened.
Yeah. But that's a two-part statute. The one is you suppress and get the property. The other is that you don't allow that evidence. They gathered the evidence off that property. Whether they give us that back or not, to me, is still, we could have suppressed that if we'd known it was there.
So my understanding from what you're saying right now is that your primary concern is that any information that they learned during this search, you don't want them to be able to use that against your client. Is that right?
Yeah.
Okay. You're not really asking for the return of something physical to your client, like a thing.
No,
a
we don't have a thing. No.
Okay.
Oh, dirt's tangible, but apparently they didn't. They replaced it.
Okay. Could you clarify for me, under the statute, under 626.21, it refers to a substantive offense. What is the substantive offense you're referring to?
The substantive offense is failure to comply, I guess, with the order.
Okay.
Which goes back to your argument. If it is the relationship between the actual request for suppressing the information having to do with the same with the crime that they're alleging. I guess to simplify it, we would argue that, first of all, the case that they use is and everyone uses, of course, clearly states that in the context of a crime, and it says it has to be a crime. We're saying that they've never, no one, this court, anyone's court, has never said, oh, well, an administrative order may be civil, but what does the tie to the criminal action be? And does that create enough context of crime? And if it does, then we would like to go back to that trial court and figure out if there was a crime, because we haven't had that conversation. We haven't even had a chance to start doing our discovery because we got thrown out so quick.
As I read this, it seems to be the contention of the respondents that they didn't need anything from the Vorings to make the restoration order.
You know, and Your Honor,
am I reading that right?
You're reading that right in their response, right? That they already had them. Let's put it that way, okay? The problem with that context is we don't really know and won't know if we could find out if that drilling actually impacted their stuff. And we think it had to, because if you go back behind that, you see that they were absolutely trying for a long time in that first meeting, an hour and a half meeting, to get to be able to drill samples.
But the DNR, their violation originated from aerial photos of parts of the property that did not contain the soil borings, as I understand it.
Yeah, there's two halves of the property. There's the, you know, I shouldn't say two halves. There's two jurisdictions controlling over it. And I guess our comment would be, I think it's a part where we're not going to let you drill. Well, I suppose if we don't let you, we could go in a helicopter and try to drill. But they were really focused on those drills.
And that may be true. But as Judge Smith was indicating, you're not really aggrieved by the drilling, at least in the DNR's order, restoration order, because it wasn't the property that for that was subject to restoration was not the same, is a different part of the property than where the borings occurred. I mean, the wetland order is a little bit different because of the road.
No, I get that. The I guess the appellants would argue that with the DNR officer there, it became a search. And the DNR officer was working with other folks from wetlands. And so those guys combined to start doing something they were told they shouldn't do. And I guess at the core of, go ahead.
Help me, well, I guess I'm just wondering, is your real concern here about the DNR order or just the wetland order?
Both orders have the same language, saying that you might fall into this misdemeanor scenario, right? Really, though, practically the way it's working out, it's more for the wetlands. That was not exactly clear when we filed the motion.
And the Bowser decision is final now. There wasn't an appeal in that.
Right.
So aren't you barred from making any argument, even if, I guess I don't understand how 626.21 provides you any effective relief relating to the Bowser matter, given that that's final and wasn't appealed. In other words, isn't this matter moot in relation to the Bowser decision and therefore the wetland restoration order?
That is true only if the court thinks that the 626.21 action is not a separate action. And that kind of information, that doesn't say anywhere in the statute that, can I answer my question?
You may.
It doesn't say anywhere in the statute anything about whether or not, or about administrative orders, anything like that. I guess what I'm asking the court to do is take a look at the underlying case law that says it's got to be criminal, and saying, well, what does criminal mean? And this would be a chance, yes or no, to say, well, they are faced with this situation. Why bar them from using another tool, 6.621, to figure out if they can get any kind of more information back and stop a process? That's all that we're asking for. Really, it's almost like, I don't want to say the word because first impression, it's an extension of what that case would have allowed. And I'm out of my time.
Thank you. You'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal. Good morning. You can proceed when you're ready.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Oliver Larson. I'm an Assistant Attorney General. I represent the Department of Natural Resources. We're splitting time in this case, so I've got about 7.5 minutes with you. Just want to let you know, my intention at least is to try and focus on the Section 626.21 argument. I'm going to leave the rest of the briefing, but if you've got questions, I'm happy to take them.
Well, then I'll ask a question,
Kevin. Yeah, go ahead.
On page 2 of your brief, it reads, the sampled soil was placed back in the hole from which it was taken. Where is that in the record?
It is not, which is why it's in a footnote. This is the best.
It's not. It's in the text.
What's that?
It's in the text of your brief.
Oh, is it? All right.
Sure
I apologize.
Is.
Sorry. But that's probably because it's in the introduction. If you look into the factual recitation, it's something we drop. We drop a footnote on this. Here's the actual facts to this. The borings were not performed by DNR. The borings were performed by the Kitson District employee.
Well, the complaint alleges that the borings were done by... I have to find the language, but the DNR officer.
I acknowledge that, right?
So aren't we looking at the complaint?
What I will tell you is I don't think this issue is dispositive of the case, but yes, I agree. There's an allegation in the complaint, but there's what I will say is this. The complaint does not plead that the DNR is in possession of anything, and that's what I was really trying to get at. The actual facts are DNR didn't do the boring, and nobody took any soil off the property, and there's nothing in the complaint that pleads that the DNR is in possession of the soil sample, and in fact, the DNR is not.
Can you help me understand, when I read all of the attachments to the complaint and the description in the complaint with respect to what actually happened during this site inspection and then the drilling of the five holes, as I understand it, I've seen in the documents that the purpose was to, quote, take data, that there were observations made, that cattail was pulled out, and that there was the sulfur odor. What happened here, and how were the materials handled? And then what was taken away from the property,
so
if anything?
Typically, this is done with what we call a Dutch auger. So basically, I don't know if you've ever had like one of these augers used to like plant tulips.
Believe it or not, I know what that is.
Okay, so like a T-handled auger, and it's got a little bit of it's basically got a circular blade at the bottom of it. And so you put it into the ground, you twist, and you keep doing this until you get to the depth that you want. You pull the soil up, you look at it. And what you're looking for is, does it look like hydrologic soil, meaning does it look like plant material that has been submerged in water for a long period of time? Sulfur, as you indicated, is one of the indications. Hydrogen sulfide would be an indication that soil had been sitting in water for a long time. You look at it, you put it back into the hole, you cover it back up, and you walk away. You just make field notes that you did an inspection at this site and you found hydrologic soil. I'm not saying that nobody would ever take these soil samples and take them off the property. I can see circumstances in which people would do that. The more typical practice, and my understanding is what happened here, is they just looked at them, observed that they were hydraulic soil, put them back in, and continued their search. So let me focus a little bit on section 626.21, and I don't have a whole lot of time. So one issue that I just kind of want to bring up with you is we briefed this kind of very simply, and I think the district court dealt with it very simply by just saying, look, Scoglin controls, right? The Nationwide versus Scoglin case has very direct, on-point language that just says, unless you're dealing with a criminal case, section 626.21 doesn't apply. That's how we briefed it. I want to provide a little bit of context. I think we didn't really tell you why Scoglin is right. I'm not sure that we need to tell you why Scoglin is right. But I wanted to give you a little bit more context based on some of the things I saw preparing for oral argument. There's something that's interesting that's going on that I think you should pick up on, which is Minnesota did not have a code of criminal procedure until 1975. And you might ask, well, what's the relevance of that? And the relevance is this. Prior to 1975, when the state needed to make a change in the way that essentially the process by which criminal trials occurred, it did it through statutes. Or the Supreme Court might eventually get around to it and do it in the common law. And so that's what we have here. And you see that a little bit in the Scoglin case, right? They talk about this statute being passed near in time to MAP. There's actually a far more direct line there. MAP versus Ohio, it's passed in 1960. Or the decision comes down in 1961, incorporating the Fourth Amendment exclusionary rule against the states. The next legislative session that occurs is 1963, and that's the session in which the Minnesota legislature adopts 626.21. Interestingly, at the same time, if you look at like the top half of chapter 626, almost all of it was edited at the same time. There's just a massive reorganization in additions to chapter 626 at the same time, dealing with search warrants. On the same day in May of 1963, all these statutes get passed. So it's very clearly that what's going on when 626.21 is being passed is that they're adopting criminal procedure in response to the MAP versus Ohio decision. The other thing, if you were to really dig in and look at MAP and some of its progeny, or an earlier case called Wolf, one of the things that you would see in this period of time, from let's say 1940 through the time that MAP is adopted, is because the exclusionary rule has not been incorporated against the states. States are taking different positions on it, and the way they're doing it is by passing statutes. Some states are passing statutes codifying the exclusionary rule. Some states are not. And so again, in 1963, when Minnesota is confronted with MAP versus Ohio, what is it doing? It's just adopting the exclusionary rule as set forth in MAP.
Counsel, I appreciate that helpful background. I have kind of a practical question for you. This matter arose in an administrative context. how is a party to challenge, raise basically a constitutional argument in an administrative context such as this one?
I see your background as an OAH judge coming out, right? Because we've told you probably many times, I'm sorry, LJ, you don't have the power to get into constitutional issues. It would be on the certiorari phase. Now, I think that, you know, we do have ALJs who look at these issues and give recommendations on evidentiary issues like this. Ultimately, it would be for this court if you know, some evidence was seized in a way that offended this court, the ultimate, that's how it would get in
and
front of you.
And how would we do that? Would we be calling witnesses to the stand here to develop a record about what, I mean, I don't know how that happens as a practical matter to determine whether suppression is appropriate.
Well,
it seems like that's a district court function.
On a restoration, at least on a DNR restoration order, there's a right to an OAH proceeding on that. And so presumably Mr. Brazier would come in and put in the evidence that he wanted to put in on this. We wouldn't oppose the admission of the evidence. It's going to come in, whatever happened, right? They can put the evidence in. We might tell the ALJ, you don't have the right to essentially create new constitutional law, but we're not going to oppose the development of the fact record. And I haven't seen ALJ saying, well, I'm not going to let evidence in on these kinds of issues.
Yeah, but those also involve, like, credibility determinations.
I think the ALJ would make the credibility determination. But
I see I'm out of time.
I'm just going to ask you one more question. In your view, then, should this have been raised through the Bowser appeal process?
Yes, and just recall here, there was no appeal filed at all on the DNR restoration order. And the DNR restoration order in no way relies on this evidence. Yes, to the extent that they wanted to get into it, they should have taken a direct appeal from the restoration order and told the Kitson District and ultimate Bowser, and then maybe this court, look, some of the evidence that was used to create that restoration order came from an illegal search, and you should expand the exclusionary rule to apply to this kind of civil remedy. That should have been the way it was handled.
Thank you. Right. Counsel for Kitson County, you can proceed. The Soil and Water Conservation District, I should say.
Yes.
I haven't seen it go up that high for a while.
Well, it's good that it does. Actually, that might be a little too high, actually. Good morning, Your Honors. I'm Marcus Jardine. I'm here with Amy Mays, and we represent the Kitson Soil and Water Conservation District. I'm going to go through some of the basic facts in this case, just the ones that we perceive as the most relevant, but because I don't have a ton of time, if you'd like me to skip ahead, just let me know. But the SWCD issued this restoration order to the appellant in 2019, and there were three violations. So the new ditch violation, the new road violation, and the field for amusement rides.
And the soil borings yielded evidence that pertained to the violation for the road, right?
That's right.
Okay.
Yeah. And, you know, I was going to get into this in a minute, but actually there's a finding in the Bowser order. It's on in our addendum at page 9, paragraph 23. And it states that Wagon Wheel, or the appellant in this case, concedes, and the evidence fully supports, that the soil borings were conducted in connection with the road, not the ditch or the proposed additional ditch and pond excavations. Because Wagon Wheel, the appellant, did not apply for a no-loss determination as to the road, the borings are not relevant to this appeal. So that's sort of the factual background that we want to give is that...
Can you clarify, when was the concession made?
I believe it was made during the hearing at the Board of Bowser hearing. That was on August 31st, 2022.
Thank you. Sorry to interrupt.
So there was no, what we want to portray to the court is that there was no appeal of the underlying restoration order. So all three of these violations are not were not considered by Bowser. It was just what was in that initial no-loss application because instead of doing a appeal, direct appeal of the restoration order, the appellant decided to do what's called a no-loss application, basically to prove that there's no net loss to the wetlands. And in that application, the only thing that was, the only one of these three violations that was in there was the ditch, and there's a proposed new pond in there that's irrelevant to this appeal. So we have this Bowser case that's basically just dealing with this one issue, and then shortly after this, the appellant separately brought a district court action, and that's what is before this court, of course, is this motion to suppress the soil samples from the Bowser proceeding.
The soil samples.
Right.
What are the soil samples?
So I believe that the appellant is referring to the soil samples or the soil borings taken for the in relation to the road violation.
Taken, what does that mean?
Well, my understanding, and I don't believe it's actually in the record what the exact process, but my understanding is what happened is they drilled and looked at the soil and put the soil back.
So you understand that there is nothing physical that was removed by your client from the property, is that right?
That's
or the
right.
premises?
Okay. That's right.
And all of the data that was collected or the evidence that was collected was through observation or data collecting, is that right?
That's right, and there's a document that's attached to the complaint. It's the Bowser, I think it's a hydrologist, Matt Johnson. He even says in there that he could perceive the hydration in the open, basically open soil on the ditch. So that's part of how Bowser could determine that they were only used for the road violation, because they, when they went out there, they could literally see the hydration of the soil along the ditch, because, I mean, it just goes right down.
So Mr. Anderson's argument is that hypothetically, if his client chooses not to comply with the restoration order with respect to the road, because the we'll pick the road, for example, because the borings, the results of the evidence gathered from the borings relates to the violation under the wetland violation under the road. And say he chooses not to comply with the restoration order and he's subsequently charged with a misdemeanor. Is it your position that he would only be able to move to suppress the evidence that was collected once that criminal proceeding has been initiated?
Well, I mean, the SWCD's position was that he can't move to suppress any of that evidence.
Ever?
Well, not now. I mean,
even in a criminal proceeding that's subsequently filed?
Right, and I believe...
Has constitutional rights.
So I believe in the State v. Cozy case that we cited in our brief, that's on page 13 and 14. So this case involves a landowner who attempted to challenge a restoration order after the county prosecuted him for violating it, including the methods that the agencies used to establish the wetlands. And this in this case, the court clearly held that this was an impermissible collateral attack. And, Your Honor, I believe that you raised this during the appellant's argument, that in this case, all that mattered, there was two elements to the offense, right? There was a restoration order that was served on the appellant, and the appellant violated it. Those were the only, and the court actually says that in the case, there's only two elements to the offense. If the court says in this case that if the appellant wanted to challenge the restoration order itself, he had to appeal it within 30 days. So the SWCD's position is that the restoration order is final because it was never appealed, and the Bowser case is final because it was never appealed. So one thing that we wanted to point out in this oral argument is that it is unclear exactly what the appellant is trying to suppress and what from what proceeding. That has caused some confusion for the SWCD. In the reply brief, the appellant states that, in quote, the appellant asked the trial court to declare the search illegal within the meaning of section 626.21, and if so, to suppress the evidence from use in the agency proceedings, end quote. In the same brief, the appellant states that he does not challenge the integrity of the Bowser proceedings. So the SWCD's confusion is that if the appellant is not challenging the integrity of the Bowser proceedings. What is the purpose of this case? And no matter what the appellant is challenging, no matter what proceeding he's challenging these soil samples in, the final orders. So there's a final restoration order from 2019 that he never appealed, and there's a final Bowser decision that was never appealed. And I see I'm almost out of time here, but with these the two cases, State v. Cozy and Waters v. Putnam, that relates to the Bowser case. What these two cases show is that these judgments cannot be collaterally attacked. So it's the SWCD's position that there's nothing to suppress. And what the SWCD would like to have happen in this case is that the case be dismissed as moot and the appeal be dismissed. Thank you.
Thank you. Any rebuttal, Mr. Anderson?
Only a couple points on rebuttal, and I'm going to kind of come clean on this about my clients at this point in time. The 626.21 action was brought after we learned some things, and we didn't have a chance to cross-examine anybody. When we say we understand or accept the integrity of the search, doesn't necessarily mean that we think it was correct. We understand that they thought they were doing it properly. And you can see that in how they answered it. They used a, I think it was a 1987 handbook from the state, from the National Guard. But the real issue is that everyone's pointing at the fact that nothing has been, that there's nothing there, but they still, at the end of the day, went on the property and did things they were told they weren't supposed to do. That's the point of this. We
so
want to see.
At this point, I understand your client's concern, but at this point, what would be the purpose of a reversal and remand? The Bowser decision is final. The restoration orders are both final. So, what would be the purpose of a reversal and remand? Those cannot be collaterally attacked.
And they won't be collaterally attacked. And they are, and it is to that point, the that order now has to be followed. We know that. And in fact, I owe counsel a call on that. But the idea is that we still want to see, for purposes of my client's concerns, how, if they violated that property, if they violated his concerns, where does that fit in? I'm not quite sure what they're going to do with that, to be honest with you. But if we got a finding that there was a violation under 626.21, I don't think they're going to go back and try to challenge the stuff that they didn't appeal. But I do believe that determination has value to my client.
Thank you.
Thanks.
I didn't mean to cut you off, but if you have other points you'd like to. Well, we very much appreciate your argument and the argument of respondents' counsel attorneys. So thank you to all counsel. The matter is submitted, and we will issue our opinion within the statutory time frame of 90 days.